The unprecedented growth of social media such as Facebook and Twitter has seen the number of defamation and harassment cases involving online content increase rapidly. The latest case is that of British activist Caroline Criado Perez, who had to endure insults and violent threats on Twitter for the heinous crime of wanting Jane Austen's image on the UK £10 note. This led to her calling the police after finding no solace from Twitter. Now the case has come to a head with the arrest of a 32-year-old man since Labour MP Stella Creasy was subject to a barrage of threatened messages from internet trolls on the microblogging site for supporting the campaign of Caroline Criado Perez. The suspect was questioned on suspicion of committing an offence under the Protection from Harassment Act. Joining me now online are blogger and tech journalist Carolyn Nillington and TJ McIntyre, lecturer in law at University College Dublin. TJ, first of all, to you, on the subject of trolling, is this something that is on the increase? Is this something that we have to take very seriously indeed?
It's something that's very much on the increase in terms of its visibility. I'm not really sure that it's something that's on the increase in terms of its overall incidence. But I think what's happening here is that the social media sites such as Twitter are making visible something that might have been largely invisible beforehand. So it's not that people bullying or people expressing abhorrent views is any way new, but rather there's much more visibility now.
Carolyn, do you see it as a serious threat?
I see it as a serious issue, but I don't think I would agree with TJ that, you know, this has always been it's there in the real world, it's there in the online world as well, and that, you know, the trolling has been with us since the dawn of the internet and the discussion forums. So it's nothing new if people spent time in those areas. It's just that I think we now have a vastly larger audience online using much easier to use services like Twitter, and the idiots jump in and make abusive posts.
Carolyn, could Twitter have done more in this instance, do you think?
I think right now we're kind of in an era when there needs to be some sort of a balance found. I don't think it's, you know, Twitter is just a tool, and you can't really blame Twitter as much as a broader awareness and maybe a slow emergence of policies on how these companies will operate and deal with these, the really problematical cases. The problem, I think, always is where do you start to draw the line between somebody being mildly obnoxious or even terribly obnoxious and then being a bully, the most, I think, overused term right now in social discourse, because everything has become, everyone and everything from governments to individual politicians to activists to people, teenagers just being rude, you know, it's now called bullying. There's a difference between the rough and tumble of online chatter and actual bullying, and I think a lot of that was highlighted by teens themselves yesterday in an RTE news broadcast item on Ask FM.
TJ, Twitter and Facebook are compared to the railway lines on which trains run, or the cables through which electricity travels. But is that a bit of a cop-out? I mean, should they be doing more to prevent whatever you want to call it, trolling, bullying, whatever it might happen to be, abuse, insulting behaviour, violent threats?
I think there's two perspectives here. I think you can certainly say that individual companies should and can, if they wish, introduce more family-friendly spaces. There's absolutely nothing stopping them from doing that. They say that this is going to be our business model, that we are a particularly friendly space. Parents can allow children to use us knowing that rude or abusive comments will be deleted. That's fine. But equally, it's very important that you have to have spaces for adult conversation as well, where, provided that content isn't actually illegal, it's permissible. And right now, we're getting, to some extent, the worst of both worlds. We're getting a demand that we apply the standards that are appropriate for children to adult places, while at the same time we won't succeed in making those places safe for children any more than we would succeed in, for example, making physical places safe for children. Demanding that, for example, Twitter be safe for children. It's rather like demanding that London be safe for children. In any physical space, there are going to be places where children shouldn't go until they've reached a certain level of maturity and age, and likewise, the same is true online.
Now, what we've been talking about there is our alleged cases of malicious and deliberate harassment. But TJ, social media can be a minefield for the merely incautious as well. We've already had cases, defamation cases in Irish law, haven't we?
We've had quite a few. And there is a perception that people are anonymous online. It's a perception that's largely not backed up by the reality. Unless somebody is quite technically sophisticated, you leave digital footprints behind you that make it very easy to identify what it is that you've done. So in many ways, the people who are sending illegal or abusive comments on Twitter or by email or on Facebook are the least of your problems, because they're very easily identifiable if, in fact, what they've done is illegal.
And just saying "I just retweeted" is no defence in the case of libel or defamation, is it?
No, because in Irish law, you're treated as a publisher if you adopt somebody else's content, be that republishing it in the case of a newspaper, for example, taking content from an author, or even in this context, just retweeting it. And that is a minefield for people, because they often feel that they can retweet content that comes from an apparently legitimate source, only to find themselves then being burnt when it turns out that the original source had their facts wrong.
Remind us about the McAlpine case in Britain. What happened there?
What happened here was Lord McAlpine was wrongfully accused of being involved in paedophile activities. And the most high-profile person to link him to that was Sally Burka. And she tweeted at the time that a programme was going out in relation to paedophile activities, "I wonder why Lord McAlpine is trending, smiley face." And this was the subject of some dispute then when Lord McAlpine sued in respect to it. He said that this was an attempt to link him by innuendo to the paedophile stories that were being discussed on television at that time. And she claimed that it was nothing of the sort. And ultimately the court found that the fact that she had identified the fact that he was trending, linked it to current events, was enough to link him to the wrongful accusations of paedophilia against him. And on that basis, she could be liable in defamation, notwithstanding the fact that she had never repeated the original defamatory content.
And Carla, when it comes to blogging, obviously you are, amongst other things, a blogger. While vying for equality and proper recognition with traditional media journalists, are bloggers perhaps less responsible when it comes to defamation?
I would say that, again, I think we're in this kind of in-between state where we have people who are less aware or completely unaware of libel and defamation law and what they mean and how they apply in their given country. And as I'm sure TJ will agree, sometimes it's not always how it applies in your own country. It's by publishing it onto an international medium like the internet, you actually potentially become liable in other jurisdictions as well that might have stricter libel and defamation law. But there was an immediate rush into blogging, especially probably, I'd say, in the period of the late 1990s into the early 2000s, when lots and lots of people came in, set up blogs, and there became this tension between bloggers and journalists, you know, quote-unquote real journalists, and then bloggers who were citizen journalists reporting on issues and commenting on issues, often with much greater expertise, because journalists are very often a jack-of-all-trades across a number of different areas, whereas a blogger might be somebody with a specific knowledge in an area. But there was a sense that perhaps bloggers wanted to be able to say what they wanted to say without understanding libel and defamation and without having the responsibilities that most journalists understand as part of their training and as part of the editorial process as well. Things wouldn't get said in a newspaper that might be said on a blog. And the law is, again, in transition in this area right now. I think there's cases which have indicated that judges think that there should be maybe a kind of a third arena where what's said on blogs or in online discussion groups or on Twitter is a more fluid and free-for-all area of less serious publication, if you will. It's more of maybe a bar situation of discussion. So, you know, but I do think bloggers, anyone who goes online really needs to understand these areas better. That's a matter of education.
Now, you mentioned obviously going online, the potential for spreading the libel increases. You are also, as you point out, you are also spreading the news, if you like, into other jurisdictions where the law may be different. But the reality surely is, given the paucity of hits that most blogs receive, is there an argument that even if there is defamation on a not very widely read blog, that if it's seen by far fewer people, that it's not as serious a libel as would be the case with traditional media?
Well, if I can come in on that, actually.
Yes, TJ.
TJ.
Because there was one very recent Irish case where a blogger settled a defamation action for €100,000, notwithstanding the fact that his blog was very much a minority sort of blog that would have been seen by very small numbers in the hundreds, I suspect, rather than the thousands. And this happened in the last few years. In some ways, the difficulty here is that Irish law is set up in such a way that you have a one-size-fits-all law of defamation. And it's a law that's grown up really with the media in mind. And that makes sense to some extent because media are quite powerful. They have very large circulation. And at the same time, the media have the in-house supports, the lawyers, the editorial assistants and so on that helps them devise and back up stories. But now you come to apply that rather draconian law to the individual blogger, and suddenly it becomes a case of applying a sledgehammer to crack a nut, particularly in the situation you outlined there, Miles, where you might have a very small readership. And I think it becomes rather unfair to the individual blogger to expose them to the same risks, potentially the same level of damages, that they might face if they were a professional media organisation.
And I suppose also, Carolyn, you have the problem because of the ubiquity of the web that if somebody feels they have been defamed, they can choose where to sue. It might not be any good to them suing in the United States of America, where the law, libel laws are quite liberal. They can go elsewhere, though, can't they?
Yeah, and I mean, there has been this situation described, you know, of sort of legal tourism and libel tourism, where the UK was for a long time a very jurisdiction, and so people would say that I'm based in the U.S., but through some tenuous connection, I'm suing in the U.K., where damages could be far more severe, and the law is narrower degree of leeway than in the U.S., where it's actually far more difficult to insist that you've been defamed. The level of proof is on the person who feels they were defamed rather than on the person who supposedly defamed them. So you do get in some cases a desire to move a case to an area in where you feel you can get the best, you can reap the best possible rewards. But the UK law has changed. I know there's some indication that perhaps Ireland could become the next destination for this kind of libel tourism unless we address our own legal situation here as well. But I just wanted to note as well, just in addition to the previous question, one issue, even though a blogger might only have 100 readers, I think one of the things that has to be recognized is that given search engine, the power of the search engine, and the fact that something online might be there for years and years and years, if not forever, however long that may be, that something that is said by somebody can actually be linked to a person's name just through a search engine.
Right. Carolyn, your line is beginning to go, so we're going to have to leave you. Thank you very much,
Dee,
for your contribution. But just finally, TJ, does defamation law need to catch up with social media, or should they just be held to the same standard? So should bloggers and tweeters be held to exactly the same standard as print journalists and broadcast journalists?
I think Carolyn made a very good point earlier on when she said that there's some indication that judges here might think in terms of a third space. Because really, historically, libel law was very strict, but it was never applied to, for example, the pub conversation, because the pub conversation was a very transient sort of thing, and the individual didn't necessarily know that they were being talked about. And that gave you an important degree of social leeway in how it was applied. Today, the pub conversation is online. Very often it's searchable, so that the individual can go vanity searching, looking for their own name, find somebody saying something disparaging about them, and bring an action against them. And I think it's very important that you have, in a wider social context, a social space where people can speak freely, off the cuff, without necessarily the same degree of fact-checking and so on that you'd expect from the media, but equally without the same degree of credibility or weight or reputation that you'd expect from the media. In other words, if people are engaged in casual conversation, which isn't necessarily going to be given the same weight as an editorial in the Irish Times, then it shouldn't necessarily be held to the same standards as that editorial in the Irish Times.
J.J. McIntyre, lecturer in law at University College Dublin, thank you very much for joining us this morning. And before that, we heard from blogger and tech journalist Carolyn Lillington.